Köszöntöm nézőinket, sziasztok! Én Papp Szilárd vagyok, a Partizán szerkesztője. Ha Németország tüsszent, Magyarország megfázik, tartja a mondás, és hát Németország az utóbbi időben kifejezetten sokat tüsszent. A német gazdaság stagnálása, a német gazdasági modell gyengülése nem csak Nagy Márton vagy Schmidt Mária megszólalásaiban, de a nyugati gazdasági sajtó címlapjain is sláger témává vált. De vajon miben is áll a német gazdaság válsága, és milyen kiutak vannak belőle, illetve hogyan hatnak mindenre a február 23-ai parlamenti választások? A mai műsorunkban ezeket a kérdéseket fogjuk körbejárni. Aki pedig segítségünkre lesz eligazodni ebben a témában, ő Max Krahé, politikai gazdaságtani szakértő, a Dezernát Zukunft berlini kutatóintézet igazgatója. Mielőtt bemutatom őt, még ezt elmondanám, hogy február 23-án vasárnap este élő eredményváró műsor keretében elemezzük majd a választások eredményeit, és azok várható hatását nem csak a német, de az egész európai politikára, így hazánkra is. Hiszen, ha választás, akkor Partizán. Most pedig következzen az interjú Max Krahéval. Thank you very much for joining us. And I would like to talk to you about three interrelated topics. On the one hand, I would like to ask you about the general state of the German economy. Secondly, about the different solutions that the politicians and business elites propose to solving current crises. And lastly, also a bit about the European dimension of all these things, how the hardships of the German economy impact the prospects of the EU economy in a sense. First, I would like to pose a very general question. There's been a lot of talk in Western financial media about Germany becoming again a sick man of Europe or the German economic model being run out. And so how would you assess the current state of the German economy? What would be the headline issues?
I would say the headline is the German model as we know it has run out of gas, ironically. The idea of driving growth through importing cheap energy from Russia and then using that to make sophisticated engineering products, often with inputs from Central Europe, from Hungary, from Poland, from the Czech Republic, and then exporting that to the world market. And by world market, mostly we mean the US and China, and to a certain extent, the European Union. That fundamental model is no longer viable in the sense of it no longer generates new growth. And so if your expectation is you're going to grow 2%, well, that expectation is going to be disappointed.
You mentioned the gas question, and there is this kind of a cliche that, that the escalation of the war in Ukraine in 2022 was a turning point for Germany. But I was listening to a podcast by Helen Thomson, the British economic historian, and she was pointing out that the problems of Germany in respect of energy started earlier, together with the fracking revolution in the US, which kind of like this abundance of energy in the US made American firms much more competitive than the German ones. So how do you see this issue playing out? Is this kind of the consequence of the war in Ukraine, or are here kind of longer term problems that were not solved?
I think the best way to understand this is to break it down by sectors. Look at the sectoral stories. And the three sectors that account for, or that are the biggest sectors for German exports, are cars, obviously, and then machinery, and then chemicals. And the story for cars and machinery is not really a story of Russian gas getting suddenly more expensive. And interestingly, the price spike or the price increase in Russian gas did not start in February 22. It started in the summer and the fall of 2021. So it's not exactly the war. It looks like there was more of a geostrategic decision by Russia to drive up the gas price. But that's a different question. So cars, machinery, chemicals. Cars and machinery, the story is really about the German car industry being blindsided by rapid progress in China, to a certain extent also underestimating Tesla in the US and betting that we will all continue using the combustion engine forever. And that was a crazy bet that misfired spectacularly and has very little to do with gas. Machinery, equally, mostly a story of the Chinese companies just getting stronger and stronger and stronger and German firms losing export share. The chemical story, to a much greater extent a story about energy and in particular about Russian gas. I mean, it was BASF, which has this huge chemical complex in the southwest in Ludwigshafen, which pushed significantly for the gas deals with Gazprom. And so there in this third sector chemicals, it's really a gas story. Of course, it's always a question of competition, and the American firms through the fracking revolution, their costs lowered in the 2010s, but the cost shock that really punched through, that was Russian gas in the summer and fall of 2021.
You already mentioned this question that this relationship with Russia is very important, but that kind of like as offering materials that are needed for production. And then there's a kind of a demand for manufactured goods from the US and also from China. And so how do you see kind of the particular configuration of dilemmas that the Chinese growth or the kind of Chinese technological advancement poses?
You've got at least two things going on that are related but distinct. You've got the intensification in geopolitical competition between the US and China, and out of that, American pressure on European firms, not always German, but also Dutch firms, to reduce the amount of business they do with China. That's kind of the geopolitical pressure story. Then you've got the Chinese growth story of, you know, Made in China 2025 and the increasing sophistication there, which of course is driven by the Chinese approach to geo competition. So they overlap, but they're distinct. And for now, for the German firms, it's really the second story that's way more important, right? For maybe ASML, the Dutch semiconductor machinery firm, maybe it's the first story, the American pressure. But for Germany, it's really about the increasing quality of Chinese firms, which has two effects. It displaces German firms from the Chinese market, and it creates competition for German firms in third markets, so in Egypt and Indonesia and Brazil and India. And we see movement in both dimensions, although for the German car industry, the biggest loss has been in the Chinese domestic market.
Here in Hungary, in recent years, we've had a lot of announcements about foreign direct investments coming from China. So a lot of CATL, the battery manufacturers, BYD, the electric car manufacturers, and other Chinese firms are also opening plants in Hungary, oftentimes very close to German firms. So, for example, the CATL plant is going to be very close to the BMW plant in a city in Debrecen, in the second largest city of Hungary. So there is somehow also a competition, but also a cooperation in terms of these kind of semi-peripheral, so for both China and for Germany, kind of important countries in the European periphery. What's your reading on this situation? Is it kind of a competition for Hungary, for Serbia, for these countries, or is this kind of a possibility for a continued cooperation?
I think in the first case, it's great evidence of the fact that trade can benefit a lot of different people at the same time, right? If there is specialization, if you have a really good labor force I'm going to butcher the pronunciation, but in Debrecen, you've got good infrastructure, you have expertise, you have firms that can learn from each other, then yeah, different players are going to come there and put their production site there because it's going to be more productive. So that tells you that trade can actually work and specialization can work, and we can all benefit from it. So I would say that's the first thing that it shows. The second thing which is reflected there is that deepening globalization does put pressure on, let's say, the early industrializers, so you know, the G7 countries, the old rich world, and that there is, to a certain extent, a race to the bottom where you will go to places where you have the skills, but also lower wages. And then, of course, both German firms and Chinese firms are going to go there to raise their profits by paying lower wages for the same skilled labor force. So you have both of the dynamics of global trade reflected in the fact that Chinese and German companies are going to come to the same location. What does it say about the possibility for Chinese, German, Hungarian cooperation? I'm afraid not a lot, right? The reason why that cooperation is becoming more difficult has very little to do with kind of direct economic competition and an awful lot more with the consensus in the American political class changing 180, you know, really changing direction, and with both the Democrats and the Republican now seeing China as a real geopolitical rival, and it's American threat perception that is really driving a lot of the European skepticism vis-a-vis China. I think if the Americans had not turned hawkish on China, the Germans definitely would not have turned hawkish on China.
You mentioned this shift in the US, and so in Europe there is, because of this, there is a kind of an increasing talk about this kind of economic sovereignty as some kind of a strategic autonomy, to use President Macron's expression. I was wondering, what is the room of maneuver for European and German elites in this respect? So do they have actually choices, or what's your assessment? Do they have choices still? Can they choose between, I don't know, following the US and integrating more, or continuing this strong alliance, or actually, or choosing a more autonomous kind of a pole building, so to speak, or is this just talk and there's not much room for maneuver?
I think there are choices, but there are no easy choices. And in particular, the idea of Europe becoming a third geopolitical pole, of positioning itself somehow independently between the US and China, I think that is to a very large extent a fairy tale, right? The hard security of Europe is guaranteed by the United States. We are prosperous enough, we have the money and we have the skills to do it ourselves if we could agree to do it. But it's just not plausible that the French and the Italians and the Germans and the Hungarians, that we surrender command over our armed forces to someone in Brussels. It's just not going to happen. The political legitimacy isn't there. The majorities aren't there. The willingness to give core constitutional powers to Brussels, which is what you would need if you wanted to do one European defense force, like, that willingness is not there. So we will have hard security dependence on the US for the foreseeable future. As long as we have that, when push comes to shove, we will have to do what the Americans can credibly demand from us. And so I just don't think there's a credible option of
Yeah, in Germany, Olaf Scholz kind of pronounced Zeitenwende, and the entire European Union is talking about this kind of increase in defense spending. The Draghi report on EU competitiveness was also kind of focused on investing in defense industries. But we also are in a situation of almost economic stagnation, low growth. So I don't see how increased investment could be done without cutting from other parts, for example, from the social safety net, or investing in digital infrastructures, or all these kind of other issues that are also very important and somehow even more important for the social contracts of our liberal democracies, so to speak. Mm. So the, for example, the welfare state is one important element of this. Can we spend on defense without cutting from social security, for example, or other areas?
The question is, who are we? I think the EU doesn't do defense spending. So there the answer is no, we can't, not because we don't have money, but because even if the EU had money, the EU can't do defense spending. It doesn't have an army. It doesn't have the constitutional authority. Like, Ursula von der Leyen cannot call, Rheinmetall or KNDS, the German-French one, and order 1,000 tanks. She just can't do it. So in a way, Europe can't do it. If you then go to the member state level, France probably doesn't have the fiscal space to just do defense spending through additional borrowing. I think the bond markets would punish France and it just wouldn't work. Germany could do it. Germany has the space, economically speaking, to do additional borrowing. We have the constitutional limit on it. So the question is, could we do constitutional reform? And we will see after the election. I think there is a possibility that we could do constitutional reform. And Germany also, to a certain extent, has the real economic resources, because the car industry is stagnating. That means a lot of engineers are no longer needed on car production lines. Some of the military stuff that we would spend the money on requires similar skills, and so you could transfer some of the labor force over, and so we would have both the financial resources and the real resources to do some of the defense spending. Now, of course, not all of the defense spending is on tanks and kind of car-like stuff. Hopefully, some of it would be on more contemporary stuff like, I don't know, drones, satellites, AI applications. There, we might have the money, but not the labor force, and so we would have to buy it elsewhere. But I think Germany could easily do it debt finance. Whether we should do it is a different question.
Let's turn to domestic economic issues and the debt break, which was constitutionally enshrined in 2008, if I'm not mistaken. So almost 20 years passed. How do you see the impact on German economy and society of this debt break? And also, if I understand correctly, you claim that its continued existence is not justified anymore.
Correct. So the debt brake was legislated in 2009 and then was gradually phased in and became fully effective in 2016. So it's only been fully operational for, let's call it 10 years, slightly less than that. So, you know, the legal bite, not that long. But the debt brake is a symbol of a deeper consensus to run very tight budgets, to run small deficits. And that has been in place since 2009, right? The political compromise that put tight fiscal policy in place, that's been in place for nearly 20 years now. The hope at the time was that by putting pressure on the overall deficit, you would get a shift in the composition of the budget away from consumption spending and into more investment spending. And this just hasn't happened. Instead, in the squeeze, what has happened is that investment spending got pushed aside, got cut, and the consumption spending stayed roughly the same. And then as we had economic growth in the 2010s, the additional tax revenues, the additional fiscal space we got through the growth mostly moved into consumption spending. So in a way, the debt brake was meant to fix the problem of budget composition, and it failed to solve that. And because it led to an overall compression of the budget, we've actually had massive underinvestment in a period of low or zero or negative interest rates and strongly negative real interest rates, where we could have borrowed not just for free, but we would have been paid to borrow, and we could have invested in transport infrastructure and education, even in defense. And we chose not to. And I don't think the debt brake was legally responsible for that, but the same underlying consensus that created the debt brake is what was responsible to the lack of investment in the 2010s.
So this is, you are referring to investment, the government or state investment in infrastructures and all these kind of things, but also there's talk about low levels of private investment as well. And I've been looking at some data showing that German households have a high savings rating. So compared to other advanced economies, German households save more and consume less than in other advanced countries. And theoretically, these savings could be channeled into private investments through bank lending and all these kind of things. So why isn't this happening?
The expected profitability. Right, you're only going to invest as a company if you think that your investment will be profitable. If you're confident in the profitability of a particular project, then you will go around and you will look for the financing, and you can get it from banks, from financial markets. You might even go directly to consumers, and you know, if it's a small business, then you try to organize your financing locally. But the driver, the initial necessary condition, is the expectation that it's going to be a profitable investment. And now we're back in kind of the structural framework of the German economy. If your original business model is you get this cheap energy from Russia and you're going to sell into these growth markets in Asia, and that growth model disappears, then the whole case for private investment disappears. And so the bigger problem for the German economy, for the private investment part of the German economy, is what's the next growth model? And frankly, no one has a good answer to this question. What's the next growth model? I mean, we can talk about the different political parties. They have some ideas, and different parties have different ideas. But at the big picture level, the debate hasn't happened yet. The kind of failure of the old growth model, what are the alternatives? Let's pick one of the alternatives. That debate is very early days.
How do you explain this kind of unwillingness to face these issues, or kind of like lack of, I don't know, political economic vision in these respects?
A, the model worked really well for many, many, many years. In a way, this model built West Germany, it built West Germany's identity. After World War II, the western part of Germany, like the eastern part of Germany, had nothing to be proud of. And in the western part, the thing that allowed West Germans to be proud again was export-led growth. The idea of building good products and then selling them first in the European market, then in the world market. And this was turbocharged by this strategy of the last 30 years, where you could say the Cold War is over, we can save on defense spending, the Americans are still there. Now that the Cold War is over, we can intensify energy trade with Russia, and look, China is coming to the world economy. So everything was aligning to boost this model. So to acknowledge that a model that worked well for 80 years has come to an end, that cuts deep. That's really, really difficult. So that's the first problem. The second problem is there are no easy alternatives available right now. Mm-hmm. Changing to an alternative growth model might eventually lead to an uptick in growth again, but in the short run, it probably means that in the best case, you have a few more years of stagnation, because the real industrial capacity that we have, all of those VW and BMW and BASF and Siemens factories that are designed to supply the world market, if we switch to, let's say, a domestic demand-oriented growth model, then a lot of that becomes dead capital. And then people have to move, and you might have to rebuild your housing stock, and the urban geography changes, and you need to retrain people, and all of that takes probably years, not months. And so until a new growth model starts paying off, that's not tomorrow. That's more in, 4 years, 5 years.
In the best position to succeed Olaf Scholz in the chancellor's office is Friedrich Merz, the head of the Christian Democratic Union. Mm-hmm. And his economic program proposes cutting taxes, deregulation, cutting back social spending, in a sense. So I saw that he is planning to restrict, for example, access to the unemployment benefit or the Bürgergeld. How adequate is this program?
It's not completely crazy. If you think that the problem is that the German economy needs to change its structure, then reforms like this labor market reform, where you would basically make it a lot more uncomfortable to be unemployed. You basically, you push people to take new jobs even if they don't really want to. If that helps to make your labor market more dynamic by moving people around more easily, then this can help with the kind of sectoral recomposition that would be needed in a new growth model. The tax cut for firms, I mean, that can work to incentivize future investment, because then the expected profitability is going to be a bit higher, but it might also just lead to reaping the profits in Germany and then investing elsewhere. And fundamentally, I don't see the recognition that a new growth model is needed. To me, this sounds like an attempt to turbocharge the old model and to double down on trade, to double down on exports. And I don't see the geopolitical strategy that would make that a credible growth model for the next 20 years, right? How is Friedrich Merz going to pacify the conflict between Russia and Ukraine, between China and the US? I don't see it.
In recent weeks and months, Elon Musk has been active in German politics, and he has been claiming that a government led by the radical right-wing Alternative für Deutschland is the only hope for restarting growth in the German economy. And so I was wondering, because AfD has this kind of radical outside of the mainstream view in many respects. And I was wondering, in terms of economic policy, how far is it from let's say, center-right economic mainstream? So how different is from CDU or FDP, for example, so the Christian Democrats and the Free Democrats?
There's significant overlap, especially with the FDP. So they both have the proposal for very significant income tax cuts, especially for rich households. So there's alignment there. There are similarities and differences on climate. So the AfD, in an extreme sense, wants to recommit to the combustion engine, so to the car technology of yesterday. The FDP and the Conservatives are talking about slowing down the transition from combustion engine to electric vehicles. So different goal, but similar short-term implication. On pensions, The AfD, it's very hard to see what they actually think, but they sometimes talk about very radical cuts to public pensions, which the Conservatives would never do because a lot of their voter base would be against it. The FDP, on the other hand, they would do significant public pension cuts. So again, you have more overlap with the FDP than with the Conservatives.
That's very interesting. So we've been talking about the two biggest parties, in a sense, who are, in a sense, kind of like driving the discussion in Germany. You, with your colleagues at the think tank Deutschland Zukunft, have different kind of analysis and also kind of proposals for how the German economic model should be rewarmed. So can you talk about a bit how your proposals would change or what you see as a kind of a way forward?
So let's start with the overall philosophy and the overall growth model. We think that Germany in particular and Europe in general has the possibility to turn to a much more domestic demand-led growth model. Right? If we boost purchasing power at home, so higher wages, but also more public spending on things like education, then we would give our firms the opportunity to sell more, to orient themselves more to the domestic market, which in times of geopolitical uncertainty would be a good thing. It would increase security, it would increase the ability for firms to plan, and we think this would be positive for investment. Now, what does that mean in practice? What are the actual policy implications here? The first thing would be to say, what kind of fiscal policy enables this? And so here we are in favor of a reform of the debt brake that creates more fiscal space for the right kinds of public spendings. And then we also looked at what are the specific areas in the German economy that need public investment, because our expertise is fiscal policy, so really the public budget. We looked at where the financial needs there. And we identified four big sectors where you have needs. That's transport infrastructure, that's education infrastructure, that's defense, and it's decarbonization. And if you do the investment that is necessary to come to good outcomes in those four areas, then you're already injecting a volume of demand that would really facilitate this growth model shift. And at the same time, you would modify the supply side to be ready for this change in growth model. You would have a better education system that could produce people who can then do high-skill labor and kind of services that work, and you would have the infrastructure to support it.
The current model has, as you also described, that in a sense it was a very successful model, and kind of the entire West German economic miracle in a sense rests on this export-led model, and it has a strong electoral societal coalition behind it. So starting with the big firms, but also the trade unions, the Mittelstand. So it's kind of a very robust social coalition that stands behind this export-led growth model. What would be some kind of an electoral or a societal coalition that could stand behind of a reform that you propose?
So this is one of the hardest challenges. What I find interesting as an observation is that the rootedness of the old model and the coalition behind it has really crumbled around the edges for at least 20 years now. So it used to be that everyone working at VW, from the design engineer to the production line worker to the cleaning staff to the canteen dining hall staff, would all be employed by VW, organized by the same union. Over the last 20, 30 years, we've seen that more and more of these groups have been peeled off. And let's say the dining hall workers are now outsourced and provided by a service company that pays lower wages, is no longer organized by the same union. So the staff no longer sings in the VW choir, it no longer plays with the VW sports team, it no longer comes to the VW Christmas party. And that's the net result of that is that the coalition that carries the old model is no longer 90% of German society, but maybe more something like 60% of German society. And this then comes back to the voting results and what used to be called a grand coalition, right? The CDU on the right and the SPD on the left. Used to account for easily two-thirds of the seats in parliament, sometimes 80, sometimes 90, sometimes 95% of the seats. And now a grand coalition is probably going to land at 55% of the seats. So that reflects the crumbling of the old majority, the old coalition. What the new coalition looks like, I don't know. I think smart trade union organizers might have an idea, smart activists might have an idea, but I'm not a smart trade union organizer or activist.
How would the European economy change, or if the German economic model will readjust?
Different for different parts of Europe. I think it would be a very significant change for Central and Eastern Europe, so Poland, Czech Republic, Hungary in particular, but also Northern Italy, where you have a lot of extended supply chains, engineering supply chains, car production supply chains, and of course, to the extent that the production volumes there go down from, you know, 100% to 60, 50, 40%, these supply chains would also have a corresponding decrease. So this would not be easy. At the same time, if Germany opts for domestic investment and for an expansionary fiscal stance, this could create opportunities for other European countries and could be a growth engine and then facilitate the transition to a more domestic European-facing growth model in the other countries. So you would have the sectoral story, and the sectoral story would be difficult, but you might also have the macroeconomic story, and the macroeconomic story would be positive.
Mm-hmm. And one final question. So you also deal with kind of the interconnectedness of economy and politics, so how economic policies influencing the kind of the quality of democracy and all these kind of issues. And what I've seen, the entire kind of like Western countries in many respects are finding their ways of rearranging their economies. And we see this in the US, we see in different European countries as well. And for example, in the US, what we see is that this resetting of the old system is somehow accompanied by power accumulation or power concentration, kind of an anti-democratic or more oligarchic kind of politics. And we see in Europe the growth of the extreme right is somehow also kind of related to economic problems as well. So what's your take on this issue? What are the biggest pitfalls or biggest dangers that face Europe in this zone of interference between politics and economics, or democracy and economic reform?
The biggest danger is the disorganization of the wider electorate. So people who are very rich will always try to have their voice heard in politics. And to a certain extent, I wouldn't blame rich people for that, because if you have a lot of wealth to protect, you're going to try to protect it. I think that's a human instinct. So the attempts will always be there from that side. The question is, what are the consequences of those attempts for the political system at large? And if you have a well-organized electorate, and this can be center-right, center-left, right? So on the center-left, we'd be talking about trade unions. On the center-right, we'd be talking about churches and village associations and that kind of stuff. And for the green part of the electorate, it might be environmental associations and activism. So it's not a partisan question. It's a question of, do people who are not rich, do they stand alone? Or do they combine? Do they organize? Do they build networks? Do they build political parties? And my greatest worry is that we still have political parties in Europe, of course, but they are heads without bodies. They no longer have these social networks, these really existing connections that gives them a rootedness and a power to then stand up against the interests of the rich. That's the thing that I'm most worried about. And then when you have a situation like we have in Germany today, where the economy is really underperforming for a number of years, and where the hopes for the future are very negative, then people get nervous, people get anxious, and they look for scapegoats. And then, of course, it's very easy for rich people who don't want to be taxed to say, look, you know who's responsible for, you know, your job loss or for your pension cut? It's foreigners. And then people who are scared and anxious and not organized, who don't have networks, they might say, okay, I see what Elon Musk is saying. Maybe I should vote for the AfD. So I'm scared of this combination of economic stagnation, attempts by Elon Musk and other rich people to protect their wealth, coming together with this brittle situation where the many, most of us on the center left, on the center right, are disorganized. That's what I'm most afraid of.
Max Kreil, thank you very much for accepting our invitation and sharing your thoughts. It was a very interesting discussion. Thank you.
Thank you for the invitation, and Looking forward to talking again in the future.
Ez volt az interjú Max Kraheval a német gazdaság helyzetéről és kihívásairól. Ha tetszett az adás, kérlek támogasd a Partizán munkáját, hogy még több ehhez hasonló interjút tudjunk készíteni az átalakulóban lévő világunk jobb megértése érdekében. A támogatási lehetőségekről minden infót megtaláltok a leírásban. És ne feledjétek, vasárnap meghívott szakértőinkkel élő adásban értékeljük a német választások eredményét. Hiszen ha választás, akkor Partizán. Munkatársaim nevében köszönöm szépen a megtisztelő figyelmeteket. Én Papp Szilárd voltam. Sziasztok!